you don't have to be a scientist. You don't have to be trained in science to have kind of a scientific lens on the world and let that influence your life in positive ways.
Hello and welcome to The Right Question, a radio program and podcast featuring authors from the American West and beyond. The Right Question is supported in part by Humanities Montana and members of Montana Public Radio, and by the Greater Montana Foundation, encouraging communication on issues, trends, and values of importance to Montanans. I'm Lauren Korn, speaking with Dr. Alan Townsend, author of This Ordinary Stardust, A Scientist's Path from Grief to Wonder. A decade ago, Alan's family received two catastrophic diagnoses. His four-year-old daughter and his wife, a scientist, developed unrelated, life-threatening forms of brain cancer. As he witnessed his daughter fight her cancer during the courageous final months of her mother's life, Alan, also a scientist, was irrevocably changed. He began to see scientific inquiry as more than a source of answers to a given problem, but also as a lifeboat and, as we talk at length about in this conversation, a source of spirituality and creativity, a lens on the world that helped him find peace with the painful realities he could not change. Through scientific wonder, he found ways to bring meaning to his darkest period. Dr. Alan Townsend is a scientist, author, speaker, and the dean of the University of Montana's W.A. Franke College of Forestry and Conservation. He is the highly cited author of more than 140 scientific articles and has served in multiple prominent leadership roles. He was named an Aldo Leopold Leadership Fellow and a Google Science Communication Fellow, and he was one of six scientists chosen to be in the Let Science Speak documentary film series, which premiered at the Tribeca TV Festival in September of 2018. He lives in Montana with his family and two ridiculous dogs. Alan, thank you so much for being here. Welcome to The Right Question.
Oh, thanks, Lauren. It's my pleasure to be here.
I want to start with your career, which is a large basis of this memoir. What is it that you do?
Well, right now, I'm a dean of a college at the University of Montana, tied to this station, obviously. But I'm an ecosystem ecologist by training, an ecologist. And so I pursued a path that's about studying the natural world and then ultimately about teaching about it. And so I spent a large part of my career mixing those two things, and you know, being out in the world and doing a variety of different kinds of scientific research and then teaching about it back wherever I was employed.
You mention a word in the memoir, biogeochemistry. This is part of your ecology. Will you dig into that word a little bit? And just for our listeners, kind of keep it in layman's terms so we can follow you.
Yeah, it's a mouthful of a word. And backing up a little bit, the number of times I've told somebody I'm a biogeochemist and they say, oh, you're a biochemist, and I get it, right? What it really is the study of the basic elements that allow life and how those elements flow through life and then through the non-living parts of the world. So cycles of things like carbon or nitrogen or oxygen that we all have to have, just how that works. And for me, a lot of the interest early on is that humans have changed a lot of those basic biogeochemical cycles in massive ways with all kinds of consequences. And so a lot of my work was about trying to understand that.
You write about the different places around the world that you've traveled doing this work, South America. You worked at Duke University. Now, being back in Missoula, has this place specifically shifted the kind of work that you're doing?
Well, that's a complicated answer, which I know you never want from a scientist. But I don't do very much active research anymore. And it's just out of necessity. And in large part, after the events of things that happened in the book that are described there, I had to make some choices. And then it's often true when you take on these leadership positions like a dean or something, you don't have much time to do that anymore. So in terms of actually being back out in the field and doing that work, I haven't done that in a number of years. you know, what I would say is that coming back here is a connection to it, or full circle a different way, in that I grew up here, and the childhood experiences of spending a lot of time in the outdoors, there's just no question that ultimately, you know, with plenty of various or wrong turns along the way, but put me on the path that ultimately became my career.
We're going to talk more about the science of this book, but what do you miss most about being in the field, Alan?
That is a great question. I miss a lot, actually. The adventure of it is fun, but what I think I miss most is kind of the mutual creativity and problem solving of the small groups that we'd be in to do it. So whether you're chewing on some bigger scientific question that you don't really understand and you're trying to figure out what is the answer and how do I chase it and what do I do, or, you know, as you said, so much of our work was in pretty remote tropical places, and so things go wrong all the time, right? Like there's just something that breaks, something goes wrong, something happens, and you're constantly presented with very basic logistical problems that you have to solve. And you know, you're in the middle of nowhere and you got to roll a duct tape and a piece of string and God knows what else, and you got to figure it out. And I really miss that. It was fun.
Yeah. You look at a lot of the misconceptions of science in this, and I feel like its connection to creativity is one of them.
Yeah.
We're going to get into that. I want to turn to your memoir directly. You write that when you received your daughter's initial cancer diagnosis, you were somewhat prepared for it. The scientist in you had already leapt into action after there were some preliminary symptoms and x-rays. You write, quote, "There are times when I wish the scientist in me would go away."
Mm-hmm.
Alan, is there something that quiets the scientist in you? Is there something that allows you to think not about the matter in front of you, but to be in the moment, to feel the feelings in real time rather than retroactively?
That's a great question, too. You know, what I meant at the time, or what I meant by writing that, I guess, is that sometimes as human beings, maybe we don't really want to know the answer, or we want to live in some kind of denial around something we don't want to hear. And I certainly had that feeling when Neva was first diagnosed. I think the other answer I would give you is that, which I try to express in here, is that for the most part, that's a false statement that I made in there. And by that I mean, not that I'm lying to anybody, but just that the fusion of thinking about how the world works and being out in it can be something that gets me away, ironically, from having to know all those answers, and just has a really nice, I guess at this point for me, spiritual component to it. So that's an indirect answer to your question, but just being out, like being out in wild places, being out doing something like that, kind of allows me to step away from just a purely answer-driven analytical brain.
You write about multiple instances where science sort of trumps the emotional reality of the moment. And maybe I'm reading too far into those moments, but you seem to fall back on science in moments of stress or high emotion. And it's when you're relaxed that you're able to kind of let the scientist go. There's actually tension to that. There's a tension in that idea with the following passage, and I'm going to quote it. "True learning, discovery, and genius are far more likely when we're in a playful state of mind, relaxed enough to be open and observant and accepting of what both is and could be." Also another quote, "The best scientists I know, their emotions are woven throughout their practice of science." I feel like there are so many threads in this memoir, Alan, that are interwoven together. This idea of science and emotion, creativity, stress. Is there a way that you can maybe triangulate those quotes that I just quoted to you and this idea of when you can leave the science behind, or when you are more in the moment?
Yeah. So I didn't know there would be a test today. I think what I'm trying to convey in that, maybe the way I would answer it for you, is that what I learned in time through this is not something at all that I would say I knew at least consciously earlier, younger as a scientist, but that as I went through these periods that were just so painful and stressful in many ways, the kind of narrowing down to some very fundamental habits that science at least tries to teach or should cultivate. And because we're humans, we get away from them all the time, right? We can be full of stress and just our scientific lives. You know, will I get this answer? Will I do that? Whatever it is, it's a very human thing. But at the core, being open and relaxed, being open to any possible answer, not being driven by just it has to be this or it has to be that, being comfortable with uncertainty, being relaxed into uncertainty is critical for doing really good science. And of course, like when things hit the fan in our lives, it's pretty important for navigating that too. So that's kind of the lesson I learned, is that really more by accident and habit at the beginning, when I would start to allow myself to just be in those habits again, I could feel my brain changing a little bit, and I could feel stress reducing, because you're just kind of in that standard habit of saying, all right, you know, I actually don't know what the answer is. And that's fun to not know what the answer is and all that. So maybe that's how I would stitch it together.
So much of this ordinary stardust leans into that uncertainty, into finding solace and acceptance, not in finding answers, but in the unknown. And this might be the wrong question or the not quite right question, but I'm curious about how these experiences, your daughter's cancer treatment, your wife's ultimate death, how they changed your science, the way that you view your career, what you do, and certainly the processes that maybe lean into those uncertainties.
Well, that's a long answer. In some ways, that's almost the point of the book, which is not to deflect, but they certainly did. And where would I start with that? I think science became a source of comfort to me, a source of, for to use a bit of a cliched phrase, of kind of soothing your soul through some of those habits and others that I was talking about. And that just starts to change. It did start to change for me how I look at the entire enterprise and what its value is. And that's a very laden thing to say, right? It's the value of science is massive.
Yeah.
You just take that hoovy groovy stuff out, right? And you just look around. The room we're sitting in, everything you're looking at is science, right?
Yes.
Our whole modern lives are just built upon it. So none of this, what I ever want to be conveyed, is like, what really matters is this. It's just that it brought this additional layer to me. And that's what got, both through my own experience, got intriguing, is that it's this, it can be this source of comfort that I think is very much like what many people find in faith traditions or other approaches to their life. And it certainly was for me. And I have come to believe it can be for lots of people. And I think that's for a whole bunch of reasons. But a deep look at how the world works tells us, for example, as I know I talk about a couple times in there, that, you know, when we're in situations that seem so bleak and so impossible to get out of, our minds have a way of getting really locked in that. And it's just how we're wired. But, you know, science is so full of examples of something that just looks awful, death, destruction, dissolution, whatever words you want to use, then being followed by just kind of something you could never imagine, right? Just unbelievable beauty or unbelievable outcomes. And so I just started to think about that and, you know, how we live our own lives, and that there's something there.
You're listening to A Conversation with Dr. Alan Townsend. I'm Lauren Korn. This episode of The Right Question is supported by Chapter One Bookstore in Hamilton, Montana, a literary and community resource for the Bitterroot Valley, providing space to explore, discover, and share passions since 1974. More information can be found at chapteronebookstore.com. You keep mentioning this idea of science as a source of, but also a kind of, spirituality. You quote Carl Sagan a few times in your memoir, one instance being, science is not only compatible with spirituality, it is a profound source of spirituality. Will you speak to how your own spiritual beliefs changed over the course of both your daughter's and your wife's cancer treatments, but also over the course of writing this book and sourcing texts like Sagan's?
Yeah. I mean, that's the first thing I should say, and credit where credit is due, right? Like any good things, this is science. Science builds upon itself.
Yeah.
Right? Like there are, that's one of the beauties of it too, is that you go from someone else's discoveries or ideas and you try to put your own lens on it, you try to add something. But Sagan's a perfect example of, in some ways, I'm not saying anything new here. It's just the process of my own discovery and maybe trying to help people remember and understand what's out there. But he was remarkable at pointing that out decades ago now. I think even as a scientist, for me, though, I'd read some of, certainly some of his work when I was young. And I was like, that's really cool. I get it. But I didn't. To be honest, I didn't, right? It was just kind of neat, or I'd like to think that way. And so I would just say my own access to something that I would call more spiritual didn't come in a true way until I went through this and just kind of needed it, like needed it so badly. And that's where science just started to hit me in a different way. And that's where thinking back to some of these things I'd read when I was younger from a very, you know, about as famous as you get scientists like Carl Sagan, meant something different to me in that moment. I understood him in a different way. And the how, I don't know that there was any one moment. I mean, your question's a really astute one in that I certainly felt some of it in the heat of all those moments and some transformation then, but I would say a lot of the real learning for me around it is kind of post hoc. And once you're a little out of the fire and looking back, and the very process of trying to write this was self-serving in some ways, in the sense that it helped me to see it in new ways. And so you're very right, like going back to materials, reading that and thinking, oh my God, like many of us do, right? Like, you know, just like any learning, when I used to teach, it's like, okay, this is a cool concept, but students always mostly tend to gravitate towards it with more excitement and more meaning if they find some way to apply it to their own lives. Like, oh, that thing, I get it. Like, that matters like this in my life. Well, suddenly a lot of these things mattered in my life in a way they hadn't before.
Absolutely. Yeah. Absolutely. I want to go back to creativity. Your wife used science as a source of creative introspection. Her science allowed for that creative space. Could you elaborate for our listeners on how these elements, creativity, science, and also trauma and distraction, which are also a part of this equation. Could you elaborate on how they interconnect and influence each other? And perhaps how your wife harnessed that creativity amidst what was very great trauma?
Yeah. Lots to say there too. I will start by saying, I don't know how she did it. She was just incredibly good at it. And yeah. So maybe I shouldn't say I don't know. I think I would equate it in some ways to a very basic principle we all know, which is that if you want to do anything really, really well, we're all wired in different ways. We have different genetics. We have all that kind of stuff. And so talent can differ. But if you really want to be good, you got to practice it all the time. And so you want to be a good writer, you've got to practice your writing. You want to be a good athlete, you got to train all the time, whatever it is, right? And so Diana, for whatever set of wiring within her, had a very burning, broad curiosity about the world and certainly about science. But that in turn was coupled with her living a life where that was just nonstop, you know, to the point where sometimes you get a little annoying. You're like, hey, what about the rest of us?
Put your work down.
Yeah, yeah. And what I realized in the midst of it, to part of your question, when she fell ill and was dealing with all of that, that's where the habit took over. And, you know, we talk about that for people or anything, that if you're so trained that your habits are automatic, you know, you think about people that do incredibly dangerous things. Folks in the military, somebody who's a special forces person who goes into incredibly difficult situations. I mean, they train and train and train to be able to respond instinctively as well, but still very well to incredibly stressful situations in an often physically active way right there. You know, in her case, I just think that daily habit that was so deep in her of being so fueled by that curiosity made it almost automatic even when just the worst had hit. And I just watched it in her. And so that's led me to really wonder about that and how much that varies in people and how true that is. But I think there's evidence, right? I mean, that's the other thing is we know that there are people who their brains are just wired in ways that they're especially creative. And then when they cultivate it, they do better under stress because of that. There's neurobiological evidence for that. And I know just enough about neuroscience to make me really dangerous, so I'm sure I'll get in trouble around this one. But you know, I talk about a little in there that you know our brains have these different major parts to them that are doing different things. And when we're happy and relaxed and just things are cool, brains tend to settle into a stronger outcome that can access our creative functions. And then anything bad happens and we're pretty quick to flip the switch into that stress response.
Mm-hmm. Which is often distraction too.
Absolutely.
Finding distraction.
Absolutely. Exactly. And so there's almost this internal battle between, you know, in reality for many kinds of stress, especially the kinds I'd say we deal with more in our modern lives as opposed to our evolutionary history. You know, this is where people should read someone I quote in the book, which is Robert Sapolsky and others who knows a bazillion times more than I do, but there's that battle, right? And you might want to access that creative side much more in the midst of these terrible moments. It's just harder for many of us to do. And in her case, it was just habit. It was almost like she couldn't help it.
Yeah.
She couldn't help it.
Yeah, and she stuck with it for a long time,
absolutely.
Right up until the end. Yeah,
right until the end. I mean, it was astonishing, and I have no doubt that was part of her. I mean, in the end, this is science too. There's only, you know, she only had so much control. I mean, the tumor she had is one that just about nobody makes it through, and she knew that. But the way she chose to live in that period was pretty transformational.
Yeah, she was a runner and astonished doctors and onlookers of how well she ran.
Yeah,
almost up until the end as well, yeah.
Yep.
I have something of a craft question for you. Mm. I'm curious about the order in which you reveal certain information in this memoir. We know right off the bat from the prologue and from the descriptions on the back of the book that both your daughter and your wife, Diana, are diagnosed with brain cancers. And yet it's not until the middle of the book, almost exactly halfway through the book, that readers learn that Diana's ultimate diagnosis was not the first time that she had a cancer scare.
Right.
Tell me about the logic or the impulse to do away with a linear narrative in this memoir. Does the narrative follow, we're speaking about memory, does the narrative follow your memory rather than time?
The narrative follows really great advice from my agent and editor.
So wonderful, yeah.
I mean, but it's just true, right?
Yeah,
and so I'm talking craft, right? I mean, again, I was telling a friend just this morning, I'm going to deflect for a moment here, but like members of the writing community have been so astonishingly kind to me in this in so many ways that I'm really humbled by it. And there are people, I've loved writing my whole life. I've always wanted to do more of it. I feel massive imposter syndrome around it, sort of working with some of these people. And I've thought a lot about craft and that and different ways to do it. But I also didn't really know what I was doing other than just sitting down and writing when I wanted to write a whole book. And so at the beginning, I really just wrote this book as in response to Diana asking me to do it and as a way to kind of help heal. And I wrote an entire draft of it and had some people read it and give feedback. And then I wrote a second whole draft of it and had some people read it and give feedback. And then I went looking for an agent.
Mm-hmm.
Thinking, oh, now I need an agent to kind of help me figure this out. And at which point the real pain began about writing the proposal for the book and thinking about what do I really want to say and how do I want to say it here. And I'm just lucky. I mean, I worked with someone. She's selling a book was a tiny piece of the whole thing of what she did for this. She was an incredible contributor to it. In terms of just thinking about exactly what you're asking. How do you tell this story? How do you reveal it? How do you make sure you are frankly, as a writer, not thinking about yourself. You're thinking about your readers and how they're going to want to experience it. And that was something that I learned from her and then from my editor, too, who's just been wonderful. So that's a long-winded answer, that the first two versions, it's a lot of the same story, but they are both more linear than this one.
Oh, interesting.
And so when I had to rewrite the book for a third time, it changed.
Yeah.
And it changed because of the proposal writing process and because of kind of working with collaborators to really help me see it in a different light.
I want to make sure that I give you an opportunity to talk about something that we haven't yet talked about, something that you want to talk about from the book or peripheral to it. I just want to give you that space now. Is there anything you want our listeners to know?
Oh, boy, great question, and I should have thought about this in advance. I mean, first, just thank you for the time and for the conversation. You know, maybe I would reiterate something I said just a little at the beginning that I really believe, which is that you don't have to be a scientist. You don't have to be trained in science to have kind of a scientific lens on the world and let that influence your life in positive ways. And that was a big part of what I got to writing this book. That was honestly a really big part of the insight from Anna, who's my agent on this, about as we work through, is that I do think those skills with a little kind of just practice and thought are accessible to just about anyone. And I really believe they're something that can help us live better and maybe just live more kindly with each other. And maybe that's the thing. I know it's such in the moment right now, but I really, you know, we live in such a increasingly polarized, fraught, divisive, stressed world where so many of the drivers of our modern society are about inducing that stress and using that stress to pit us against each other. And it's damn effective because, ironically, much of what works is based in scientific research and it's applied for bad reasons. And trying to think about science through a different lens and use some of what I try to describe in here, I think is also part of how we can, you know, maybe step back more into that creative side and step back more into being comfortable with uncertainty and then maybe do a better job of just being with each other.
Alan, thanks so much for joining me today.
Thanks, Lauren.
That was Dr. Alan Townsend, author of This Ordinary Stardust, A Scientist's Path from Grief to Wonder, out now from Grand Central Publishing, an imprint of Hachette Book Group. Look for more information about Alan at mtpr.org, where you can also subscribe to our podcast and follow us on Facebook and Instagram. You've been listening to The Right Question. This episode was produced by Chris Moyles and me. I'm your host, Lauren Korn. Chris also engineered this episode. The artwork for The Right Question was designed by Molly Russell, and our music was written and recorded by John Floridis. Funding for The Right Question is provided by the Greater Montana Foundation, encouraging communication on issues, trends, and values of importance to Montanans. Many thanks to Humanities Montana for supporting this program since 2008, and thank you for listening. The Right Question is a production of Montana Public Radio.